Welcome, everybody. My name is Jenny Friedman. I'm an ADHD coach and the host of the show.
Yeah, we need a lot more people talking about ADHD because
it's invisible.
If you had a pair of glasses that can make you see the invisible, what would ADHD look like?
If you're wondering right now where your glasses are, you're probably in the right place.
This show has a mission.
Demystify and destigmatize ADHD once and for all.
Stuff isn't rocket science, people.
Today, I'd like to welcome Eric Tivers of Tivers Clinical Specialties, which include counseling, psychotherapy, ADHD coaching, and consulting services. When he's not busy with his practice or running the Chad of Northern Illinois support group or his Rewired community on Facebook, he's creating podcasts dedicated to helping those who have really good intentions but a slightly wandering attention. How's that for an intro?
Yeah, that's great. It's funny because I've been thinking for a while about completely changing my intro.
Oh, okay.
Because I want to make my why a lot more clear. You know, it has a lot to do with the belief that we can do better. I mean, that's with having that self-compassion, increasing self-awareness, and just a steadfast belief that no matter what the challenges are, we can improve our situation.
Absolutely.
So I'm trying to figure out a more eloquent way of saying that.
Well, that's pretty good. Just like that. So on this podcast, what I like to like informally talk to people with ADHD and without ADHD, about ADHD, because trying to pair up misperceptions is sort of where I find I'm explaining all the time to people.
Yes.
You know, and I was thinking, because I have been a raving fan of yours for so long, one of the things that I see a lot of people struggling with is with the jobs situation and how can I find a job and keep a job in this, you know, when they're managing their ADHD. And then to me, here you come as a really good, like, example of success and striving, and you have ADHD, but I mean, you've got a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
Really exciting, wonderful stuff. And maybe if you'd share some of that journey to how you got here.
Okay, I'd be happy to do that.
Does it start with how you decided to get into psychology?
It starts with, well, my background is in social work. I actually chose to do social work instead of psychology because I was looking at how many math classes you need to take, and it was less in social work.
Yes.
So
I understand.
It's funny because one of the reasons that I went into this profession, not the top reason, but one of, is that in my mind I viewed this as a profession that you don't need to wear a tie.
I love that.
You know, it's just like, the idea of wearing a tie to me just was like so aversive. I'm like, I know I don't want to wear a tie ever.
No, it's real. My husband feels the same way. Yeah, it's real. When you have to wear a tie, do you become like this other person? The formal self or something?
I don't know what it is. Like, you know, occasionally I'll like throw one on right before I'm going to give like a big presentation. And then like at the last minute, I'll just take it off. And I'll be like, nah, this is not, I don't feel me, you know, it's.
Right. Yeah, you feel like someone else. Yeah. All right, so you were like, all right, let me do the social work because less math.
Yeah, so it's less math. I discovered I had ADHD after I almost failed out of college, and I was an undecided communications major at the time. So I got a bunch of D's in communications courses, and so I decided I was going to switch my major, and then. A friend had recommended that I take a social work class, and I fell in love with it. You know, it was very a lot of it was based in kind of ethics, and which was very, you know, one of the reasons I didn't really like communications was I kind of felt like I was being taught how to manipulate the public, which in a lot of ways in marketing and advertising you are, but like the, you know, when you think about manipulation, it carries a very like negative connotation to it, but it's really, you know, if we can kind of strip away that like the negative connotation of it, it's you're trying to communicate a message and convince people of something. You know, so it's, but, you know, and part of it was, you know, I didn't realize how much I struggled with writing at the time. Like I knew that I wasn't a great writer, but I didn't realize the significance of the struggle. And so I think that was part of why I was doing so poorly. You know, like I was taking these like technical writing classes and I was just like, it was just hard. It was hard.
Yeah.
So yeah, my profession was in social work, and I had like internships and jobs all kind of in that, and I you know, kind of pursued, it was a lot of discovery of figuring out what I didn't want to do.
I think that is part of the successful journey.
Mm-hmm.
I don't fall in the camp of I've always wanted to do this one thing,
mm-hmm.
and then I went and I did it, and I'm always done it. That's
right.
So few and so rare. So
I mean, by the time I was 21 years old, I had 21 jobs.
Wow. That's like, you might be Tom or Dunn's record.
he probably got me beat, but
well, not in total jobs, but in the time frame.
Yeah, I mean, it was like an average of 3 to 6 months typically per job. You know, it was right. Like I just got, it was retail most of it, and I just got bored of it. And you know, but there's like I worked at Domino's when I was in college, and I actually loved it. And I had a total, just, you know, typical kind of ADHD thing. I misread my schedule. I went home that weekend. Came back to work the following weekend, and I was fired because I was supposed to be at work.
Right.
Which I was so bummed about because I really liked that job. So, you know, I know that I'm the type of person that needs to, I'm always looking for ways to improve systems. That's just what my brain, like, it's like, I can't help it, you know? So if I'm not in a position where I can, in a sense, lead and have input on what I think, you know, I don't do very well.
Right. You're naturally troubleshooting.
Yeah. All the time.
That's cool. Yeah. So, okay. You did finish college.
Mm-hmm.
And then
finished college in 5 years. Then I worked for a couple of years at a therapeutic day school, got some kind of job experience, discovered that I really like working with kids with autism, and then I went back to grad school, got my specialized in school social work, so I got my school social work certification, discovered that schools were probably not going to be where I want to work because of just how like bureaucratic and kind of political it can be. You know, I had two internships, one I got fired from, I look back and I try to take to look at it and see, okay, what could I learn from that? Because it really was like, I don't like the whole notion of saying it wasn't my fault. Like I didn't read the political climate well enough, and I didn't like read that the assistant principal that I was like, you know, in this conversation I was having was a total whack job. Like I just like assumed the best, like that. Okay. Like I'm following my ethical code and like trying to, you know, but it's like, but then there's the real world. And I kind of like, so it was a valuable lesson for me. So I had to get I got a second internship, fortunately in a very good school that was in the city, in Chicago, where the person I was working under was both my internships had focused in autism. And this, the other social worker that I was working under in Chicago was working on her PhD dissertation on using something called joint attention, using music for kids with autism. So it was like a perfect fit because I'm also a musician. And you know, my first day at this school, the principal gets on over the intercom, and they're doing the state testing, and she like facilitates this like 10-minute like guided meditation. I was just like, where the hell am I? Like, it was what, I mean, it was a really great progressive school.
Yeah.
And even in that climate, there was still so much like the principal said to me, like, cause I was doing this thing where I was, teaching students, that were some at-risk students that were 7th and 8th graders, using, it's called social norms marketing, where the whole idea is, teaching people that actually most students don't like use drugs and alcohol. Despite the belief that they do. So it's teaching them this notion and then using a social learning kind of exercise where they would then create things and go into younger classrooms and teach them these kinds of things. And so they created all these awesome bulletin boards, and there were some parents that didn't like the word, like, marijuana on a bulletin board.
Of course.
And the principal said, like, look, like, I think what you're doing is great. But here's the fact of the matter. We have this arts program, and it's one of the gems of our school, and the parent that's complaining about this is a huge funder of our arts program. And she's like, I'm not telling you that what I'm telling you right now is right. She's like, it's just, this is what it is. And so, like, I really respected her approach to that, you know, because she could have just taken the more just, like, non-emotional, not taking something as a teaching opportunity, like, and she, you know, but that taught me that, you know, schools probably aren't going to be where I'm going to want to work, because, like, when I see a social injustice, when I see something that's wrong, it's, I don't keep my mouth shut.
Right, you're not going to just, like, roll over and go, okay.
Right. I've gotten better at that. And it's not because it's not even that I'm impulsive. It's not that I'm saying my mouth shut because I can't keep my mouth shut. It's when I see something wrong, like, I just, from an I have this, like, something needs to be done kind of urge.
Right. And that probably does speak to your whole, the appeal of ethics in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
To you.
Yes. Yes.
You know,
yes.
Which is really cool.
Yeah.
I know we've had a discussion before about APA. And, you know, there is... All big organizations have politics involved.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on how much you want to get, play their silly little game,
mm-hmm.
or go in and make changes. And I commend people that really do roll up their sleeves and try to do that. Yeah, anyway. So go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted you. That's the amazing part that brought you into the whole, okay, I get it, clinical social work and mm-hmm. doing that. But how did you decide to go into your own practice?
Well, all right. After I graduated from grad school, I got a job working at I was a clinical program manager running a residential group home. It was in a nonprofit organization, pretty large organization. But so this group home had 10 kids that were there. Most of them had an autism diagnosis. All had intellectual disabilities. You know, the staff. You know, they were direct care staff, and in that field, you know, you're not looking at highly educated people. You're looking at people who, you know, a lot of them. There was a large population of employees there that were from Nigeria. So, you know, it was very interesting learning different cultural kind of approaches, because my job was to teach them how to become experts in something that, you know, how to help them shift from just, you know, providing kind of caregiving to actually providing clinical intervention. That was making, you know, a true difference while understanding the value of, you know, understanding that they're in many ways have a very large kind of caste system. There's different tribal elements. And so understanding which employees came from different, like, was actually really relevant to, you know, to helping lead some of the changes in this job. And I love the job, you know, I like the direct care. I liked the, working with the employees, because it was a challenge. I mean, the training them is a challenge, and I enjoyed that. What I didn't like is how much paperwork was involved in it, and the, you know, I was on call all the time, which I hated, because you know, with having ADHD, it's like sometimes your just brain's not there, and so, like, when you get that call and your brain's not ready to, like, be like a functional human being, it's really hard.
Yeah. Yeah, that kind of flexibility is, and the paperwork just too.
Oh, I remember, like, there was one of the homes had this, like, basement that it was, like, had old offices in there, and there were times where I would, like, literally pull it all night working on these reports, like, there, and it was crazy. So I burnt out in about 18 months, which is longer than most people there. So, you know, it was, I enjoyed the clinical stuff, but the administrative stuff, it just killed me.
That's very common.
Yeah.
You know, it's very common, especially if you're doing really well in mm-hmm. a practical way, that they advance you into doing more management level stuff that really just means more paperwork and more things that you're not really, that's not the strength.
Right, right.
You know.
Yeah. So, you know, there are lots of parts that I liked about the job, like the training, and, you know, and part of that kind of speaks to one of the things that I love to do, and that's to give presentations and teach, you know, because I think that, you know, it's it that way you can inspire and educate people to that is really going to have a very synergistic effect. So it's taking what I know and spreading it to more and more people to really help make a positive difference in people's lives. So then I got a job after I was like, you know, when you get to that point where you're like, oh my God, I have to go to work again. you know,
I must eat.
Yes, I found a job working at a clinic doing applied behavioral analysis for kids with autism, ABA kind of therapy. It was so cool. So I was able to, like, I was working with these board certified behavior analysts, or these BCBAs, who like just take behavioral therapy to a whole different level, because it's so data driven and it's so like shows like, the value of how really how scientific we can take learning and behavioral change. You know, for me, one of the coolest things in that job was there was I was on a team of four other therapists with this kid that was getting intensive therapy about 20 hours a week. He was 3 years old, nonverbal, with autism. And it was during one of my sessions with him that we got his first words.
My God.
It was just, it's awesome. It was just so, to see that, like, you can shape and pair and, yeah. And then, so I was doing that and really enjoying that work. And I was working with this 10-year-old kid who had what we called Asperger's syndrome, which we now call autism. But I was a really, really smart, quirky kid who I just loved working with. He was just like, he was witty and quirky and kind of nerdy, and I just loved him. He was great. And his parents were really highly educated, and I looked forward to that session like every week. It was just, it was wonderful. And so I had recently got my LCSW, so I became licensed so I can now practice on my own by law. And I'd always planned at some point I would do private practice. I knew that's something I always wanted to do. So my wife and I, we bought a home. And this was on a Monday. I think it was like November, about 5 or 6 years ago. On that Friday, I got laid off. So now I had a mortgage and no job.
Yes.
And, you know, I look at this as like, okay, so I felt like this is the perfect thing in a sense for me, kind of in hindsight, because I didn't really, I didn't even panic. I was just like, I mean, sure, for a moment I did. I was like, I kind of couldn't believe this was happening, you know, like it was, and the way they did it was very, I just felt kind of crappy. Like it was a 5 p.m. kind of thing. Like they didn't want me to take clients is really what it is. And they offered me a severance package. And they said, you know, part of the condition of the severance package is you don't contact clients. And like, so I'm like, okay, I have this mortgage now coming up. And now I have to basically like, in a sense, it's client abandonment. So that is against my ethical code. I got to tell you, it was like, I had to pay my mortgage. And, you know, I still think about the fact that I hadn't terminated with those clients appropriately all the time.
Right.
Like it
right.
You know, I think at some point I'll probably reach out to them.
You're like, is there like a date or time when...
There probably is, you know, but it's...
I would think so. Because we're human beings that can...
Yeah, it was just, you know... It was unfortunate because as a clinic, the owner that was a clinician who was just, she was brilliant. I really thought she was. And I do think she is. I mean, the stuff that I learned from that place was invaluable. I think it made me such a better therapist in so many ways. But like they ran it very much just like a business that was trading commodities in a sense, which was, you know, like you have to document every billable hour and non-billable hour to say what you're doing, which like I get the value in that in some regards, but just the way it was done, it was very micromanaged. On my way home from getting laid off, I reached out to my clinical supervisor and basically shared with her what the person that I did my LCSW supervision hours with, and told her kind of like what's happening, and I'm like, help.
Do you know anybody?
Exactly. Well, and so she recommended that I call one of her mentors that she had, throughout being a social worker. And so I reached out to him and met with him, and He gave me this very simple piece of advice that was proved to just be remarkably helpful. And he said, go get a map, put yourself in the center of that map, go, you know, draw a, I think he said 25-mile radius. I think I did like a 10-mile radius.
Like
I don't like to go too far. I don't know. So I reached out to, I don't know, a dozen or so different clinics that do similar things to what I was wanting to do and serve similar populations that I wanted to serve. And I just went and met with them. And that was what he really recommended. And just see what people are doing. See, you know, what services are not out there. See what services are out there. And just go meet with people.
The biggest, I think, benefit that this guy offered you was, like, put yourself in a spot where you can network with people within a, you chose 10 miles, mm-hmm. but within a radius around you. And because you had a mortgage to pay, you just got let go from this job. So you started meeting people, and mm-hmm. what happened? Like, you met...
Yeah, so I met a bunch of people, and one of the things that, you know, one of the really awesome things that I found someone who I had, you know, I'd seen them advertise in a Chicago Parent magazine. It's a local kind of resource magazine. And this person, his office was in Volo. And I remembered seeing that and knowing that we were moving to Volo. It's the town that I live in. And so I said, you know, here's a great opportunity to reach out to this person. So I reached out to him and, you know, just to kind of introduce myself to him. And so I've been, for the last 5 years, I've been basically renting space from him. So, I mean, that, and, you know, there's not many things that are, you know, 5 minutes or less from my house, but my office is one of them, which is awesome.
Yeah.
So I met, you know, a number of other people, put me in contact with some people. And it just, you know, everything worked out. The whole notion of just go out and meet people. It actually, part of that, too, was, I think, the driver for helping me get involved in CHAD. You know, so I knew that there was a local support group meeting, and so I went there, and they announced that the person that was leading the meeting said that she was going to be stepping down and that she's looking for people to take over. And so it was like right place at the right time.
Right. So wait a minute. So the meeting the people, like going out and meeting your people, mm-hmm. you had the intention simply to meet your people,
yeah.
who do things like you. You didn't go out with a certain agenda in your mind of let me set up a place, let me get involved in this. Like you just,
I basically went out there to tell them where I was at and say, you know, I'm looking to start my own thing. I just moved out, and I shared my story, like what you know, I you know what I've done, that what I'm you know thinking about doing, and just trying to get kind of I want to meet other people and see kind of what's out there. So it's very kind of informal. Just trying to build some relationships. And one of the things that, you know, it's that I kind of took away from the whole experience is, you know, I still don't like to make phone calls.
I don't either. I swear, we have a lot in common. I don't either.
And, you know, what I found was, you know, because it's so much easier to just, you know, I'll just, you know, browse the web and see what I can find that way. It's, and I found that I got, you know, I moved so much more quickly on moving forward when I picked up the phone, when I met with people face-to-face.
Well, face-to-face, I like.
Right, you know, and...
The phone, I have a thing
Well, right, about, but, you know, sometimes you need to pick up the phone to make that maybe a meeting happen.
Right.
You know, and the way I kind of think about it is, all right, so somebody puts together a website and they prioritize what information is relevant to put on their website. But there's a whole lot more information behind the person that put together that website. So it would actually be much more efficient to just talk directly to that person.
Yes.
so, you know, my first client I actually got was, I was at one of these like 24-hour gym places. It was near my house, and I was wearing a Walk for Autism shirt. Happened to meet a parent of someone who had a kid on the spectrum. So we kind of got talking, and he became my first client. So it was that whole idea really reinforced to get out there and, you know,
yeah.
be visible. And, you know, so I went out and I went to as many different kind of related support groups as I could. Just to be there and be present. You know, I got invitations to speak at local support groups, and that was very helpful. And that still is helpful. I'm probably my number one referral generator is giving presentations. And it, I think, too, it's not just getting out and giving presentations. I love giving presentations. Like, I view that as play. Like, it's, like, I get such a rush and such, like, I get so in the zone and just, like, I really enjoy it. So I don't think just, like, you can get up and give a presentation and, you know, whatever business you're in and get clients from it. Because you can also have it, I think, have the opposite effect if you're, you know, boring and, like.
Well, right. I've seen you in action. When you, because I know you can sing and you can play your piano.
Were you at the ADA conference?
No, but I saw the tape of it.
Saw the video.
Yeah. And I really wished I could have been there because, yeah, that was great.
It was fun.
The tape was great. You're very impromptu. Like, you're, so you don't need to know that you're on. You're just up in front of people and you're. You turn on.
There's absolutely. And it's funny because I've told other people this, that naturally I'm a mumbler and so much of my job is talking, you know? So it's like constantly when I'm in the car with my wife, what? And I'll just repeat the same thing the same way. It's like, when I say what, I mean, speak up or it's something about either being in front of people or, you know, doing this. It something is activated in my brain that allows me to really, kind of step it up. And, you know, it allows me to, in a sense, be more of the person who I want to be, you know, so it's kind of that, I don't want to say it's like the gun to the head, but it's like the sort of that added pressure that kind of turns on and stimulates my brain just a little bit more to help kind of activate and organize myself.
Right. I always say it's not peer pressure, but it's almost like peer pressure. There's something, and I always say a little healthy dose of peer pressure is good. Something that makes you like, oh, you know, put on your best behavior or speak your most articulate self. That's interesting. So, okay, so that's how you started. And that's also how you started getting clients and cultivating this business.
So it was 6 months from the time I was laid off to the time I had my first client. And then it was 6 months from that point that I had a pretty thriving practice. I don't know if I would say it was full, but it was thriving. You know, the first 6 months I was taking insurance, and I realized that if I were to continue to take insurance, I would then become a patient of somebody else's practice. It was hell. Like, so I hired someone to help me with it, and it was even to that point, and I said, you know what? I'm not taking insurance anymore. It's making me a not as effective clinician because I'm so like thinking about the administrative stuff and putting it off and I'm overwhelmed and I'm not getting paid and how good is that? So I took the plunge, became a cash practice. Probably 90% of my clients stayed with me, which was great.
That's awesome. I know that is something that comes up a lot. Is it covered?
Yeah. I mean, in most of my therapy clients, you know, still get reimbursement through their insurance since I'm an out-of-network provider.
That's good.
I just don't deal with any of it, you know, because I just, like...
Right. That's on you.
Right.
It's on you.
Right, right. I mean, it's... When I think about, you know, how much time it would take me to just get somebody a bill, it's really not that much time, but I hate it so much that I pay someone to just have access to my calendar to be able to pull that stuff off and get bills. I mean, that's my red zone. I talk about my strengths and weaknesses, you know, working with clients, you know, that's my green zone. As someone with ADHD, I know how important it is for me to really work as much as I can in my green zone and figure out ways to either work around the red zone or ask for help.
Right. Yeah, I always tell that to people too. You either got to do it yourself, you got to get someone else to do it, or it's not going to get done and you need to reconcile that in your own head.
Yes.
there's really no other options. Totally. It's those three, you know? So it sounds like you did a lot of networking and, you know, resource, like looking for resources and to insert yourself in environments and that you then also really tapped into just your strengths and really just delegated your weaknesses.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and really, and in a sense, and also doing so in a way that's non-apologetic, and in a way that is modeling for my clients, because it's I so just so much believe in just that power of just being authentic. And you know, it's interesting. I was talking to someone. I was on another podcast last week. This podcast called Selling the Couch. It's a podcast for private practice. And this idea that in our training, a lot of in mental health professionals, a lot of our training has like teaches us you don't share yourself. And I just, you know, I don't agree.
I know.
Now, I've certainly had clients where, like, I would share something, and then I would see right away that they, like, they kind of took that on as a burden to them, and I made a very strong note regarding this is not a client to share with. You know, so it's using clinical judgment, and it's not just, you know, I'm not sharing because it's cathartic to me to share. I'm sharing because, like, I think it's so important for people to realize that, like, look, like, you know, when... that's why I've been so interested in Brené Brown's work, her, you know, the power of vulnerability.
Oh, yes.
Is, you know, when you can share with other people that, like, look, this is the real me, and by trying to live secretly in this world of things that you forgot to do, things that you think you should be able to do.
The world of
shoulds. The world of shoulds, the very, you know, shoulddy thinking, and, you know, that comes from... Dr. Ellis with you know, rational emotive behavior therapy, and it's a really important mindset and thing to understand that we all have these things that, and if we don't kind of reconcile them, if we don't acknowledge them and be open to understanding them, we're just going to struggle more. You know, it's kind of the idea: if I don't acknowledge it, I'm not going to struggle. I haven't seen that work yet.
Right. Well, I think one of the episodes that I can't say it's a favorite. The ones I've listened to, I've enjoyed them all. So, you know, but I was really particularly the one where you were driving.
Yeah, ADHD, 55 miles per hour.
Yeah, because you were just so, you weren't trying to be anyone but you're just yourself in that moment. We were flies on the wall in your car. Yeah. Like, you know, and there's a place, but it's the framing around it. It's when you frame it like, hey, guys, this is me and my, you know, I think the line to cross is when it's not intentional and then you're making the client be like your therapist.
Right, right.
You know, but when you're intentionally framing something mm-hmm. out saying, okay, here's an example, like you said, modeling, I think it's healthy. I think it's why I enjoy what I do and am enjoying this new podcast land that is...
I love podcast
if
land.
I could do... I love podcast land.
If I could do nothing but this, I would be so happy. Anyway, before we go, I have one last request. Please tell everyone how mm-hmm. they can find you.
Yeah, you can just go to ADHDrewired.com, which is just another page on the EricTivers.com, because right there you can select to go to iTunes, to go to Stitcher, to go to SoundCloud.
Perfect.
You know, and you can see all the...
Any way you want to access some Tivers.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, get all of me there. Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at EricTivers. I'm on Facebook.
Okay. Well, I knew you'd be a wonderful guest today. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
Music provided by podcastthemes.com. If you enjoyed the show and like to be a sponsor, be sure and check out my Patreon page at patreon.com/CinADHD. There's a lot of fabulous awards and prizes and goodies for helping me keep this show going. That's it for the show, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. And whether you have ADHD yourself, or live with or love someone who does, or both, remember, we're all in this together, and everybody benefits when we begin to see through the other's eyes.